Today, I think we've got a very appropriate subject, given that one of the things that happened during the summer was the House of Commons vote on our participation in the war in Iraq. Some of us were less keen on that than others. We had a debate in the House of Lords where I expressed my own doubts. But the important thing was that Parliament was having a chance to discuss it, and that was something which I think is important in this modern day and age. But that is not the same as the decision as to who takes Britain to war. And it's that which we are looking at today. We have two speakers, both of them Conservative members of Parliament. James Gray, who is the Conservative MP for North Wiltshire, used to be my neighbour when I was in the House of Commons, who's got a particular interest in foreign affairs and defence. He is chairman of the Armed Forces Parliamentary Trust, and he's a member of the House of Commons Defence Select Committee. He has been, or still is, on the Speaker's panel of chairmen, but he has actually written this book of the same title, the Who Takes Britain to War, and there are copies of it. If any of you at the end of the meeting would like to buy one, you'll find it on the way out. Second guest speaker today is Jesse Norman, MP, who was educated at Oxford and at the University College London. He has run an educational project in communist Eastern Germany, Eastern Europe rather, and he's been director of BZW. He's taught philosophy at UCL and Birkbeck College. He has a very wide set of interests. He's on the boards of the Hay Festival, among other things, and the Roundhouse. He has written books and pamphlets, including The Achievement of Michael Oakeshott, and then also one called After Euclid Compassionate Conservatism. He was elected MP for Hereford and South Herefordshire in 2010, and he's a member of the Treasury Select Committee. He was chosen as Parliamentarian of the Year and Backbencher of the Year in 2012. And in 2013, he was asked to join the Policy Board at 10 Downing Street. His latest latest book that he has produced is a biography of the 18th century statesman Edmund Burke, which has received great acclamation. So I've introduced them both. I'm going to ask them both to speak on each side of this particular topic for about 10 minutes to a quarter of an hour, after which, as usual, I'll open it to the floor for comments, questions, and hopefully we'll generate a conversation, if not a debate. And I will close the meeting firmly, as I always do, at 2 o'clock, even if I have to cut off some people who might want to intervene. But one of the things I've always said to you is that by having a firm cut-off time, we tend to cut down the number of people who drift away while the meeting's still going on, and that is rather easy for the speakers. So without more ado, I'm going to ask James Gray to speak to us.
Well, Michael, ladies and gentlemen, can I first of all say it's fantastic to be asked to be here, not only because I'm extremely enthusiastic about this particular subject, and not only because it's a pretty blatant attempt to promote my new book, which you can buy at the back of the room, all good bookshops near you, for a crisp £10 note, it'll come your way. But also because I've just recently been going through my parents' papers. My mother died recently. I've been through boxes and boxes of papers, and they had a huge correspondence with your parents over many, many years. And Tilly Lothian and my father, who was the head of the Church of Scotland, were great friends and had great discussions about moral matters. And I think that both of our late parents would be delighted that you very kindly invited me along today. Did you know, I'm sure you did not know, ladies and gentlemen, that since the year 1700, Britain has been engaged in 124 wars altogether. We have fought in 171 out of the 193 states recognised by the United Nations. And since the Second World War, there's only one year in which a British soldier has not been killed in combat, and that is the year 1968. Every other year since the war, we've lost soldiers in combat. Now, that shows, I think, how active we've been in the military sense around the world for a matter now of at least 300 years, and, of course, before that as well. But of all those wars and conflicts, only two have achieved the approval by a vote of the House of Commons prior to deployment. The first and the only main one so far was in 2003, when Tony Blair achieved a massive House of Commons majority for a war which I suspect that probably few people in this room today would view as being legitimate or worth fighting. Thereby, I think, at a stroke demonstrating that the existence of a vote in the House of Commons does not necessarily prove the justification or worthwhileness of a war. The only second vote before deployment was a week ago last Friday, when, of course, as Michael correctly said, we voted in favour of airstrikes against ISIL in Iraq only, and I'll come back to that in a second. But the thing in which we voted was extremely constrained, a very tight little motion, and we voted in favour of. That's only the second time in history that the House of Commons has voted to go to war. Now, there are those around, and Graham Allen being one of them, and the Prime Minister being another, William Hague being a third, who are strongly of the view, and they express this view every time you ask them, that it is only right that the House of Commons should now, for all time in the future, vote on going to war. They say things like, none of them are here, and Jesse will not be advancing this argument, so let me advance for the moment. They say things like, going to war is the most important thing the nation can do. It's greater than any other activity, and therefore it's right that the tribunes of the people, we, the members of Parliament, should be the people who decide to do so or not to do so. They would say that it's terribly important that we should do. Now, I think I'm right in saying, I won't steal this thunder, but I think I'm right in saying that Jesse will in a moment be arguing there's a constitutional flaw in that argument. There's a misunderstanding of what members of Parliament are there to do. I won't take his constitutional wisdom from him. But that is definitely the line that is running. And it's been said recently, for example, that if we decide to bomb not only ISIL in Iraq, but also ISIL in Syria, that would require a further vote in the House of Commons. Presumably, if we decide to have any kind of soldiers on the ground of any sort at all, that would require a further vote in the House of Commons. Presumably, if ISIL spill over the border by mistake into Turkey, that would require a further vote in the House of Commons. We're going to land up with votes and votes and votes and votes and votes to conduct one operation. Now, I just think that's actually entirely wrong from a diplomatic and from a military standpoint. Since over the last 200 years, we've conducted all of these wars. We've done so successfully not by having some kind of democratic legitimacy for them, but because the Prime Minister and the generals and the heads of intelligence services have done what they believe is the right thing to do for the nation and for the world under the ancient royal prerogative which was handed down to them. Now, I think that is the right thing to do. I don't think that asking a member of Parliament like me, a backbencher, it may be that I have a majority of only 100 in my seat, it may be the general election next May, and it may be that I receive 1,000 emails from armchair generals telling me not to vote in favour of a particular war, or indeed to vote in favour of it. I think that actually by democratising war in that way, we're actually getting away from what we ought to be doing, which is projecting British power around the world for the good of the world. And a whole variety of other reasons why I think, why I think that actually asking the House of Commons to decide going to war is just the wrong thing to do. It achieves nothing at all in terms of improving our strategic positioning in the world, but does constrain us to quite a significant degree. Now, for a moment, let's have a look at the motion that we passed last week. If you believe that ISIL are a bad thing, and I'm not totally convinced that we can cure them being a bad thing, but let's imagine that we accept they're a bad thing, and let's believe that airstrikes are the right way to deal with them. Why on earth was it that the House of Commons motion specified the airstrikes should only be in Iraq, not in Syria, despite the fact the two tragic beheadings of the Brits were in fact in Syria, and actually, and if there's any logic at all in airstrikes, it would be against ISIL in Syria rather than against Iraq. Why did it go to such lengths to say we must not have any kind of ground troops? Was this because the Prime Minister thought that was the right thing to do from a strategic standpoint? Of course not. No one would say it was. Was it because he thought that was the right thing to do from a humanitarian standpoint? Of course not. Sending in drones, as we're now doing instead, is not necessarily the right thing to do from a humanitarian standpoint either. The reason why the Prime Minister had to bring forward that very narrowly drafted motion was because he knew that he had to get the support of the Labour Party in order to get it through the House of Commons. In other words, we've gone from strategy and humanity and for all those things that the Prime Minister can do by deciding himself who goes to war, down to the lowest common denominator of politics. Rash politics, and at the time just going up general election, it'd be the worst thing of all. He'd be doing deals with backbenchers. If you vote for me, next general in the forthcoming vote, I won't have this war or I will have that war. And it's actually reducing the strategic and the diplomatic strength of the executive to a most absurd degree. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there are those around, my co-author of the book, Mark Lomas, QC, who would argue that we must, for that reason, continue with the royal prerogative. And, of course, I might agree with that. I think if we could continue the way we have done for hundreds of years, and the Prime Minister could use the royal prerogative to go to war, that would be great. But my own view is that the The genie is out of the bottle. I don't think we can go back to days when the Prime Minister would simply do that himself. I passionately feel that having votes in the House of Commons the way that we are currently doing is definitely the wrong thing to do. And I have therefore come up with what I think is a newish solution, which is that we should write the theory of the just war, which is an age-old theory and has developed over the years, the reasons for going to war, the way in which war is conducted, and indeed the way that you end war. You write the theory of the just war into statute. It wouldn't be easy to do. It would take an enormously long time to do. There'd be huge arguments as to what would be just and what would not be just. But surely a group of intelligent people could produce a law which says this is what war should be. It would be a law which could then be amended as the centuries went on and people changed their views on what was legitimate and what was not legitimate. But you'd then have a statute which said, under these conditions here, the executive can take us to war. The Prime Minister would then act under that statute. He would do as he does at the moment. He would just make his strategic decisions. He would not have to refer back to Parliament. He also has to take Parliament with him, of course, take the country with him. But he'd not have to refer back to Parliament for a vote. The Prime Minister could act more or less as he does at the moment, but instead of doing what he has done up to now, acting under a royal prerogative, he would by that means be acting under a parliamentary prerogative. And I think that's actually the right way to solve this particular conundrum. So thank you very much.
Michael, and thank you, James, for that terrific introduction. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, this great forum for having me along. You won't be surprised to learn, rather disagree with James. As Michael's pointed out, I have made the double blunder of turning up without a book. without my book on. Burke. And Burke has a lot to say this, I think you'll discover. And one point we might start with is the question of the royal prerogative. The royal prerogative, as you know, has evolved over a period of time, and it creates a very delicate balance in our constitution. The Crown is not above the law, but is free to execute policy as it sees fit within the law. Parliament's role is to make law when required, vote the supply necessary, and hold the Crown to account. And that balance has evolved over many centuries, and there have been particular inflection points, of which, obviously, as you will know, the Glorious Revolution and the creation of the sovereign power of the Queen, the King, as it then was in Parliament, was a very important one. Or as Burke describes it, that, you know, he regards that as a temporary deviation required to sustain the Constitution. Now, the idea of James II going into exile and an entirely new king devoted to a Protestant succession being a temporary deviation may be something that you enjoy as a thought. So what do we have now? Well, we have a new convention which has arisen over the royal prerogative. Historically, foreign policy has fallen under the royal prerogative. The new convention is, as James has indicated, that major foreign policy interventions have to be approved, pre-approved indeed, by a vote in Parliament. Now, I think this springs from honourable motives. I think Graham Allen and those who take this view are wrong, for reasons I'll describe, in fact, profoundly wrong. But I think they speak from honourable motives. And I think it's perfectly understandable given that they should take this position, given the current lack of popular trust in politics. On the other hand, I do think it is a profound mistake. And perhaps I can just touch on some of those things as to why. James has touched on some of the political aspects of why it's a mistake. And he's talked about the pressure that parliamentarians may be put under by their own constituents. He's talked about the need, as it were, to amend and then continuously amend a piece of legislation or to have further debates if that were required on further motions as foreign policy escapades or episodes or events took shape and interventions took shape overseas. I make a slightly more general point about practicality. I mean, the fact of the matter is that however expert they are, and many MPs are very expert in issues of foreign policy, they are inevitably far less well-informed than ministers who follow and reflect on the issues every day in the Foreign Office. MPs do not generally have access to officials and advisers. They're not generally privy to diplomatic traffic or secret intelligence. They're not briefed by may not demand briefings from senior members of the armed forces. MPs are a large corporate body, that's what Parliament is, and as such lack the capacity to react quickly and without warning to fast-changing events. And the result is delay. And as you might imagine, of a Member of Parliament for the constituency of Hereford and South Herefordshire, I have a lot of constituents who have an interest in the issue of delay. And the idea that members of our armed forces, from any aspect or any part of them, should have to delay deployment in theatre until the parliamentarians can get together to make up their mind that it is or is not a good idea, is extraordinary, and maybe one of the reasons why our armed forces are struggling to identify suitable targets is because we haven't had enough of our men in theatre long enough to be able to identify those targets. So, and of course, when, and this isn't a point I've made in the parliamentary debate, in the 3 minutes I was allocated by the Speaker to make a rather important constitutional argument, but when the House is given information by a government that's absolutely intent on getting a vote through, sometimes, unhappily, we have discovered that information has proven to be partial, misleading, inexpert or otherwise inadequate. Now, what does all that mean? Well, I think it means that the House of Commons, is not in a proper position to give authorisation required as required by this convention. But I also want to go further and suggest that actually, as a matter of basic constitutional principle, it should not be asked to do so. I mean, there are different cases, and we must not, I'm not laying down a rule, but just a general concern about this. As James has pointed out, and as I've alluded to, it's a basic purpose of Parliament to hold the government to account for its actions. The royal prerogative allows government, with all its advantages of preparation, information, advice, and timeliness, to act, and it is then, according to our constitution, for Parliament to scrutinise that action. So what happens then if Parliament actually authorises such action, doesn't merely discuss it, doesn't merely debate it in Parliament, actually authorises it in advance with a motion of the House? Well, the first thing that happens is it gives up part of its power of its scrutiny. It gives up part of its power to hold the government subsequently to account. It binds members in their own minds to a specific positive course of action, rather than allowing them the opportunity to assess each government decision on its merits in the circumstances. And instead of being forced to explain and justify their actions, ministers ultimately, they may not ever say this, but they can have refuge in saying, well, actually, when all things came to it, you know, we put a case before you and you authorised it. What's the effect of that? Well, I think the effect of that is that this apparent move towards democratisation, far from increasing the proper accountability of the executive, actually reduces that accountability. Far from enhancing the reputation of Parliament, it compromises that reputation and weakens its status and authority. And far from restoring trust in politics, it's likely to undermine that trust in future. Now, how did we get here? Well, I think there's a more fundamental issue, which is that far too few people in public life attend to constitutional history and the issues that are raised by any kind of attention to constitutional history. It's as though our public debate has become ahistorical, and therefore we're able to believe, for example, there is one thing called democracy which consists of a vote at the ballot box, rather than have a much more subtle and nuanced conception of accountability and legitimacy as being conferred by matters of due process, custom and procedure, and all the things by which we've been able to enjoy both a degree of legitimacy and a degree of flexibility in our constitution. So I have a kind of explanation of the pathology of it. And I would draw your attention to the fact that when we've had great decisions, they may have been foregathered in advance and well flagged and understood, as the Second World War, when we were taken, the war was declared without any positive votes of Parliament. And then when it turned out that the leadership at the time, Mr. Chamberlain, was inadequate to the job, he was unhorsed. When war has sprung up on us at short notice, as in the Falklands, Mrs. T convened Parliament for a Saturday debate for the first time since Suez, and nevertheless it was an adjournment debate, it was not on a votable motion of the House. And so we have mechanisms for dealing with these things. Let me close with two points. How should we fix this? Well, the Graham Allen approach is to go further. And to my mind, it should be obvious why I think this attempt to double down in this kind of mindless misunderstanding of democracy is a mistake. And I don't convict Graham of any kind of mindlessness at all, but I do think that approach has got a deep inconsistency and a deep lack of wisdom about it. The second thing we could do is to adopt James's approach, which is highly ingenious, the idea of replacing royal prerogative by parliamentary prerogative. I worry about that. I worry that it would make decisions in some sense justiciable because they've been brought directly by the form of legislation. I worry that that legislation might itself then be subsequently endlessly amended as each generation of parliamentarians arrived and had their own view. I worry that there isn't a stable theory of just war that could actually even in principle be written into our law. And I worry that James's own concerns about the decision to declare war becoming a kind of endless ping-pong, that this actually could have the effect of increasing that problem rather than reducing it. The fact is, as Churchill might have put it, the mahout must guide the elephant. Occasionally the elephant, if he's not happy, may throw him off. But it's the balance created by the wise mahout who knows how to guide the elephant that creates that shared knowledge that keeps them both out of trouble. And if I may, I'm just going to end with a final thought, because I thought, in honour of the augustness of this occasion, I'd go back to the man on whom Disraeli modelled his own early constitutional understanding, and Gladstone called a magazine of wisdom, the subject of my biography, Edmund Burke. And Burke says in his wonderful appeal from the New to the Old Whigs, I'll just give you a line because I think it perfectly captures this. He says, "It is not necessary to teach men to thirst after power, but it is very expedient that by moral instruction they should be taught, and by their civil constitutions they should be compelled to put many restrictions upon the immoderate exercise of it and the inordinate desire. The best method of obtaining these two great points forms the important problem to the true statesman. He thinks of the place in which political power is to be lodged with no other attention than as it may render the more or less practicable its salutary restraint and its prudent direction. For this reason, no legislator at any period of the world has willingly placed the seat of active power in the hands of the multitude, because there it admits of no control, no regulation, and no steady direction whatsoever. The people are the natural control on authority, but to exercise and to control together is contradictory and impossible." Thank you very much.